So unfortunately, we're not going to be together Shavuos. So we're not going to have the opportunity to talk about something that is relevant to the Yom Tov of Shavuos. I'd like to do that today in our last class learning together. And I want to focus on a Mishnah in Maseches Bikurim. The Mishnah writes in Maseches Bikurim, and the reason why it's relevant to Shavuos is because Shavuos is referred to as many different things, but one of the titles that we give it is Chag HaBikurim. This is the holiday where we start, where we get involved in the mitzvah of Bikurim. So let's see a very interesting Mishnah in the very end of Maseches Bikurim, Perek Gimel, Mishnah Gimel. It sounds very distant to us because we don't have Bikurim today. We really don't practice this mitzvah today. But it's something that is going to be very relevant. What is Bikurim? Bikurim is when the first fruits grow on the tree, you're supposed to bring them up to Yerushalayim, you're supposed to bring it to the Beis HaMikdash, and you're supposed to present it to the Kohen. That's what we're going to be talking about. So says the Mishnah as follows. Hashar holech lefnehem. They used to have these farmers that were traveling from all around the country, and they would be coming up toward Yerushalayim. And as they were coming, they had a big procession, a lot of fanfare, a lot of commotion. All of them would come up and converge onto Yerushalayim. Now, when we talk about Yerushalayim, Yerushalayim of old meant that it was the small old city of Yerushalayim, which is even smaller than the old city of Yerushalayim as we know today. So it was a very small space, a very small area, and you had tons of people who were coming from all over the place, all over the country, coming to present their Bikurim in the Beis HaMikdash. So they had these animals that were walking in the procession in front of them, Vikarnov Mitsupos Zav, and they used to have gold-plated horns on their heads, these animals. Va'atara Shal Zayis Barosho, they would put some kind of crown on the head of the animal as well. Hachalil Makel Lefneim, they had a band with flutes and drums. Ad Shemagiyim Karv LiYerushalayim. Okay, now the procession makes it to Yerushalayim. Higiyu Karv LiYerushalayim, Shalchu Lefneim, they used to send messengers out from Yerushalayim to greet all of these farmers, all of these guests who had come. And they would send out all kinds of deputies and representatives and delegates to go and usher these people in to the city of Yerushalayim. Now here's a curious phrase. L'fi kavod ha-nechnasim ha-yu yotzim. Based on how important you were, based on how prominent the farmer was, that is the kind of reception that they got when they got to Yerushalayim. And we're going to get back to that in a few minutes. Now, finally, the Mishnah says, V'chol bali umniyah shebi Yerushalayim. As these farmers were walking through the streets of Yerushalayim toward the Beis HaMikdash, all the different vendors and shopkeepers, all the merchants used to come out. Omdim lifnehem. They would stand up in respect to all of these people. Bishalim bishlomam. And they would ask how their trip was. They would inquire how they were doing. And they would say, Achenu anshe hamakom ploni. They would say, farmer from this and this location, Basam l'shalom, we are so happy that you made it here peacefully, that you made it here safely. Now, the Gemara Maseches Kiddushin wonders, why is it that suddenly when we have the mitzvah Bikurim, everybody's standing up for these farmers? Why are we standing up for them? Since when do we stand up for a person who's doing a mitzvah? Every time you go to light Shabbos candles, do we say that everybody else in the room should stand up out of respect to you for lighting the Shabbos candles? We don't do that. Do we say every time a person does any mitzvah, everyone else in the room has to stand up out of respect? So what is this all about, that when we come to the mitzvah of Bikurim, suddenly everybody is standing up? That is the question that the Gemara asks in Maseches Kiddushin. It is repeated again in Maseches Chulin. And the Gemara gives two answers to this question. Answer number one is, Kedei shelo tehe machshilan liyasid lava. What that means is, we have a very difficult mitzvah. Just imagine to yourself how much it takes, how much they need to invest in order to get to Yerushalayim. You have a farmer. What kind of business do you think this farmer is making every year? Not so much money. For them to be able to take off time to bring all their fruits to Yerushalayim, to stay there for a day or two, and then travel back, could be a two-week journey. That means 2 weeks off of work. That means 2 weeks leaving my family. And there was no public transportation. There was no quick way to get there. So this was a very, very difficult mitzvah to fulfill. And therefore, when you have somebody who's involved in something that is difficult for them, that is challenging, we want to encourage them to want to do this in the future. We want to encourage them that they should feel good about the experience in order that they should walk away with a positive feeling. What's interesting about this is, again, we're not talking about a generation where we have Bikurim today. Mehera Yibana Beis HaMikdash, we should be so lucky to have a Beis HaMikdash, and then once again, all of this will be relevant once again. However, before we get to that, it's still relevant to us Bizman HaZeh as well. Why is it relevant to us today? So there's a big discussion in the modern-day poskim about the following question. We know that the halacha is, Pikuach Nefesh is Doche Kol HaTorah Kula, which means, human life is the highest of all values from anything else. And therefore we assume that even though Shabbos is extremely important, if somebody's life is in danger on Shabbos, you have to do everything to violate Shabbos in order to save the life. That we know already. I think we had shiurim about that, or that was last semester, I can't remember. But we did speak about this, and it's something very, very important for everyone to know. V'chai bahem is the most important value. Says the Gemara, v'chai bahem, which means you're supposed to live by the experience of Judaism. When we talk about that, the Gemara says it even means afilu safek pikuach nefesh. It doesn't mean if someone's life is certainly in danger. It means even if someone's life is potentially in danger, and we think that maybe by not violating Shabbos, that danger can become exacerbated, we would say that you have to violate Shabbos even for a doubt of pikuach nefesh, because we don't take chances. When it comes to someone's life, we don't take chances, and that is what the Gemara says. Okay, so much so that the Shulchan Aruch quotes from the Talmud Yerushalmi, HaShoel HaRezeh Shofech Damim. If on Shabbos a situation comes up, a medical emergency, and instead of rushing to the hospital, you go and start asking questions, oh, am I allowed to drive? Should I be doing this? Should I be doing that? Instead of tending to the patient immediately, HaRezeh Shofech Damim. It's as if you have committed murder. How could it be murder? What did I do? Nobody died. The answer is because you're right. Nobody died this time. But if you're going to be lax on these issues and not take responsibility immediately, ultimately someone is going to pay the price with their life, because there's going to be a critical situation and we're not going to be careful enough, we're not going to do it at the right time, and somebody could ultimately lose their life. So that is with regard to pikuach nefesh on Shabbos. One of the highly contentious issues, and pikuach nefesh issues come up every single day. As I walked into class, I got a call from Mount Sinai Hospital. What was the call? Not from the hospital, from people in the hospital. So there's a family in the hospital. Unfortunately, they have a child who's very, very critically sick. And the doctors really don't have any treatment plan as of now. They haven't figured out any way to treat this child. And seems very clear, al pi derech hateva, based on natural order of things, the child is unfortunately going to pass away. And they had spoken to my father yesterday about how they should deal with end-of-life issues and what exactly they should do or they shouldn't do. And the question that he just asked me now, the family called all together in the room, together with the doctors, and what they wanted to know was that, you know, my father said that they shouldn't do any extreme measures to prolong the life of a person who is suffering. But what they wanted to know was, this child, unfortunately, is intubated. And what do you do with somebody who's intubated? Even if they're suffering, you can't extubate, because that would be killing them, right? You can't take out the intubation, because then they can't breathe. And that means that you're killing them via diet. You're killing them by the action that you're doing. However, it is reasonable for doctors to do an extubation to try to wean the person off an intubation, to make them learn how to breathe again on their own. So what he wanted to know was, if you're going to do an extubation because the doctors feel medically that they should extubate to try to see what happens when a person tries to breathe on their own, and then they see after 30 seconds that it doesn't work and they have to do the intubation again, are we allowed to say that that patient is already considered to be extubated and therefore you don't have to do the intubation again? Or do you say, no, it's as if we never took it off? This is still in the middle. If you take it off for a whole day and we're trying it out and we'll see what happens, then we say you don't have to do the intubation again. But over here, where we took it off just momentarily to see how the patient will do you say this is still part of the same intubation as the original one, and therefore we would say that you don't have the ability to leave them off of it and allow the body to take its course? That was the shaila I got literally right before class today. Pikuach nefesh questions come up every single day. Unfortunately, it's a tragedy every time, and we should never ever lose the sensitivity of how painful it is for a family or for an individual or for a doctor also. Very traumatic for a doctor to have to deal with these kinds of things. But still, this is something that we have to be proficient in. We have to be aware of the halacha, we have to be aware of the facts, and we have to be in contact with the medical establishment to really make sure that we're making the right decisions based on and informed by the halacha. So the question over here is, when we have an emergency on Shabbos, we know we do everything. The question that rose in the last generation by Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and others was, is that member of Hatzalah who goes on that emergency call and brings the patient to the hospital, are they allowed to return home on Shabbos after they do everything in the hospital that was necessary for them to do? Now, of course, if we're dealing with a situation where the community doesn't have enough members of Hatzalah, and if this member is going to be stuck there the rest of Shabbos, we're going to have a problem here because people won't be able to be treated, That's not a question. They're allowed to come back because that's a potential pikuach nefesh. We're going to need their services. But say, for example, you live in a community where there are plenty of emergency volunteers. We don't really need this individual. There's nothing special about them more than any other. And there's plenty of people for all the volume of calls that we expect and anticipate to have over the course of a Shabbos. Would we say that that person is allowed to come back on Shabbos or perhaps not? This was a major machlokas between Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Very famous machlokas, whether we say, Hitiru sofa mishum tchilasan, do we say that we should allow it? If they're allowed to go on the call, then it means they're allowed to come back from the call, or do we say that those two things have nothing to do with each other at all, and each one needs to be judged on its own? One of the personalities in the last generation that weighed in on this issue was Rav Herzog. Rav Herzog was the chief rabbi, it was a great Talmud Chacham, and he has a tshuva sefer called Heichal Yitzchak. And when he writes about the issue, his assumption is as follows. Based on our Gemara, when you have a difficult mitzvah, we need to do everything possible as a community to encourage you to want to do it more, to want to do it again. Now what's going to happen here? You have a member of Hatzalah who works all week, very busy, comes home Friday night, finally sits down to a meal with his family. He's very excited for the first time in the whole week. He has a chance to sit down with everyone, all of his children. Bam! Right after they make Kiddush, he gets a Hatzalah call, runs out of the house. And it's an early Shabbos. So it's 4:30 when he runs out of the house. So what happens? He goes on the call. Now he's going to be stuck in the hospital for the rest of Shabbos. What's going to happen next Friday night when he gets a call? He's not going to want to go. Last week I went, and look at the price I paid for going. Not only was I not rewarded, I had to stay there. I was stuck there for the rest of Shabbos. That's terrible. I had to be away from my family. I had to sleep on a chair in the lobby of the hospital. He's not going to want to go again. We need to do everything to encourage a person to want to do something, especially when it's a difficult mitzvah to do. And that, says Rav Herzog, is something that he felt was a very important piece to this question. It's not only about the specifics of Hitiru Sofa Mishum Tchilasan, do we allow this, do we not allow it, what are the technicalities, but beyond it, he said, we have to take the sensitivity in mind of the fact that maybe he won't want to go next time because we didn't do enough to encourage this person to want to do it next time. You know, it's interesting, the Ramah writes in Shulchan Aruch Yeradei in Hilchas Tzedakah, the Ramah says something very important. Lo yispar adam bitzdaka shehu nosei. You are not allowed to flaunt, you're not allowed to broadcast or display the charity that you give. V'im mispar, and if you choose to take credit for the charity that you give, says the Ramah, lo dai she'ena mekabel schar ela afilu ma'anishim oso aleha. Says the Ramah, you will be punished for the tzedakah that you gave because you only gave it for yourself. You just wanted people to recognize you, to hear about you, and therefore the Ramah says you're not allowed to take credit for the tzedakah that you give. What's the rationale behind that? The rationale is HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave a person money, not because he wants you to become famous, not because he wants people to adore you, but rather because he believes that you are a trustworthy person to deal with that money. You are a Gizbar Shel Hegdish, which means you are a representative of HaKadosh Baruch Hu to give the money to the proper places. It's a tremendous achrayus. Someday there's going to be someone in this room who's going to end up being a multimillionaire, right? It's going to happen. Someone in this room, or multiple people, and you should realize that it's a tremendous achrayus. It's not easy. It's not easy to be poor, and it's not easy to be rich. It's a tremendous nisayon. It's not easy to give out the money properly. And the Gemara tells a story about Anshei Anassos. Yirmiyahu HaNavi gave a curse to Anshei Anassos, who were very wealthy, prominent people, and they ended up giving the tzedakah to the wrong causes. And the Gemara says they were punished for that, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu trusted you with money, and you ruined the investment. Imagine how you would feel if you gave all your money to an investor, and then they made very poor choices, they made very poor decisions. You would be very upset. They lost all of your money. HaKadosh Baruch Hu feels the same way. If a person is given money, it's because the Ribono Shel Olam trusts that person to be able to make the right decisions, and that is not an easy thing to do at all. So, giving out tzedakah is very difficult, and says the Ramah here, it's not about me, it's not about what I feel, it's not about what I want, it's about what does the community need, it's about how can I help in the most impactful way to do positive things for the world. That's what I have to think about if I'm a person who is of means. Not about taking credit for myself. Says the Gemara, an interesting story, Maseches Ksuba Samach Vav. The Gemara tells a story about Nachdiman Ben Gurion. Nachdiman Ben Gurion was one of the three most wealthy individuals in Yerushalayim at the time of the Churban Beis HaMikdash. And the Gemara says that people used to come into his house and they would be filled up with food even when there was a famine and everything. He took care of everybody. Amazing. One fine day, one of the Amoraim sees his daughter walking on the side of the road, picking up kernels of barley, picking it out of the garbage. And he turns to her and he says, are you the daughter of Nakhdiman Ben-Gurion? Are you the one whose father was this wealthy individual? How are you picking barley out of the garbage? What happened? And she said, my father lost all of his money. And this man turns back, this Amora turned back to the girl and he said, how did your father lose all his money? What happened? And she said, because everything he did, all the tzedakah, all the charity that he gave was only l'chvodo hu di'avid. He did it for himself. He just wanted his name all over the buildings and he wanted everyone to adore him and he wanted everyone to celebrate his contributions, and as a result of that, the money was taken away from him. So it's a terrible story. It's a tragic story. But that's what the Gemara tells us. I once had a shaila, which I think is such a moving, beautiful shaila. Somebody in a community called once, and they said that they are extremely, extremely successful. They have a lot of money, but they never wanted anyone in the community to know about their contributions, about their charitable givings. So they started a foundation, charitable foundation, called it something else. Instead of using their own last name, which is the normal thing to do, that you, if you start a charitable foundation, it's called Schechter's Foundation. Instead, they called it Greenberg's Foundation, right? So they have the Greenberg Foundation, and they hired someone in a totally different state to be the one to oversee the, I didn't mean to call you out, but that's fine. Yeah. So they, that was just the name out of a hat. So they started this foundation with somebody else's name, hired a person to be in charge of giving out the money and being responsible for it, and they never had anyone in the community know about what it was that they were contributing. So it was pretty curious when the community was collecting for a mikvah and they made an announcement on Shabbos that we need to raise money and we're going to have a campaign. And all of a sudden, the next week, there was a $500,000 check. And nobody could figure out where it came from the Greenberg Foundation. How strange. Why is the Greenberg Foundation in New York care about what's going on in California? How did they even find out about it? Nobody knew what was going on. Now, along the way, he never wanted anyone to find out what was going on. So he always, aside from the major contributions he was giving from his foundation, he also did the same thing that everybody else was doing. So everyone gave a $500 check to the mikvah. He also gave a $500 check that they shouldn't be on to him. And then he sent from the foundation a major check. And this was the school, the mikvah, the shul, everything. He upheld everything in the community. He said his own children didn't even know about what he was doing. Now he has a daughter in Shidduchim. And he said, for years, this is the way we've been doing things. Matan b'seser. I never told anybody. Nobody knows. But this has been me all along. And he said, the problem is, he's concerned. There are people in his community know what kind of job he has, know what kind of income he makes, and they think that he's a miser. They think that he's a very stingy person who's not willing to share his money. Now, little do they know that the only reason why the school was built in town and why the mikveh is there and why the shul is there is only because of him. But he never said anything. So he thinks it's going to negatively impact his children's shidduchim, because people, when they're going to be called about his family, are going to say, yeah, you know, he's a very stingy person. Look, you know, they never really participate in any meaningful way. So he wanted to know, should he be more worried about his children's shidduchim and the possible potential negative impact that it's going to have from him being quiet? Or do we say matan b'seser is such an important value and it's so special what he's doing, he has a schus for that and he has nothing to worry about? An amazing shaila. No? An amazing shaila. That was his question. I know you want the answer. That was his question. Anyone struggling with the same question? If you would tell me that, then you wouldn't be Matan B'Seser anymore. So I was so moved by the question, because this is a real Baal Tzedaka who's in it for all the right reasons, who does exactly what the Rama says here, that we're not in this for ourselves. We do it because HaKadosh Baruch Hu entrusted us, and he wants us to do this. The Magen Avraham tells a story, amazing story, about a community that wanted to build a shul, and they did what every other community does. They sent out letters, and they told everybody that we want everyone to contribute, and everyone should give whatever they can, and that was the plan. And one person stepped forward and said, I would like to build the entire shul. I want it to be dedicated in my family's name, but my condition is that no one else is allowed to participate. I'm going to give all of the money that's necessary to build the shul. I want the schus to be entirely mine. No one else has the chance to be a part of it. I want it to be mine. And they asked the Magen Avraham, does he have a right to do that? Everybody wants to contribute. Now this person comes and overwhelms everybody and says, I'm going to contribute on my own more than all of you put together. So is that appropriate, or perhaps there's something wrong? And the reason why the person wanted to do it is because he said, I'm getting old and I want that my family should be remembered. And that's the way to be remembered. If the shul is going to say, the Greenberg shul, everyone's going to know forever that we were very involved in the community. We were good people. So that's the question that he had. And the Magen Avraham writes in the name of the Sefer Hasidim that he was very stubborn and he didn't allow anyone to participate with him. And in the end, he says, V'kala Zaro. His family was wiped out. You worked so hard to try to make sure you're going to be remembered, that everyone should think about the Greenbergs going forward, Rahman al-Islam, that everyone should think about whatever the family name is, says the Magen Avraham, quoting the Sefer Hasidim, that family was wiped out. HaKadosh Baruch Hu showed there are ways to forget this family anyway, and HaKol Bidei Shamayim. But here, the Ramah says very clearly that we have to be careful not to flaunt the charity that we give. Now, you're probably wondering, then, why is it that every time you pass by any brick in this building, it says somebody's name on it, right? Every classroom has somebody's name on it. So how can that be? Doesn't the Ramah say you're not allowed to? So the Ramah then comes back. You look here at number Gimel, and he quotes, in the name of the Rashba, one of the Gedolei HaRishonim, says the Rashba, Mikal Makom, even though it's true that the gold standard is don't ever put your name on anything and don't allow yourself to take the credit, because why are you taking credit? HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave it to you, so use it well. Misha magdish davar litzdaka, somebody who gives something to charity, mutelo sheyichtav shmo alav sheyehelo lezikaron v'ro'oi la'asoske. Says the Ramah, you're allowed to put your name on it, even though it's probably not lechatchila, but you're allowed to put your name, and why are we okay with that? Ro'oi la'asoske, and it's even the right thing to do. Why is it the right thing to do? Because if other people see your name on it, it's going to encourage them to want to do the same. And we're all human beings, and we all like to have some respect, and we all like when people admire us. So, you know what? Since we're all human beings, let's think like human beings. And because we know that by getting respect for doing something good, maybe we're going to do it again, that's a good enough reason, says the Ramah. Kidei shelo tehe machshilan li'asad lavo. Exactly what the Mishnah says here. When you have a difficult mitzvah, I write a $1 million check to build a shul, I write a $500,000 check to build a mikvah. If that happens, I want people to celebrate my charitable giving in order that next time I'm going to want to do it again. You know what a good feeling that is? When everybody's celebrating what I've done. And therefore, says the Ramah, because we understand the psychology of people and we know that this is important to people to be recognized for what it is that they've done, and that will help encourage them the next time around to want to do it further, therefore the Ramah says this is something that ultimately would be okay. You know, I just had a family that texted me out of nowhere last week from out of state. And they wrote to me that we'd like to give $100,000 to charity in your honor. And whatever, I started talking to them, like, that's really, really nice and really special. And I'm not sure why it's in my honor. I don't know what I did for them, but that's what they want. And I was very humbled by it. And I started talking to them about, like, what should we do with this? You know, where should it go? And even once we figure out which organization it should go to, what should the organization do with it? And I was so moved, aside from the fact that they want to give this and they're very charitable people and they really want to do great things, aside from all of that, the fact that they're not interested in any credit. They said, don't you trust an organization? Like, if the organization feels that they're going to figure out how to use it, like, why is it my business to tell them what they should do with it? If the organization needs money and they're doing good things, so let them figure out how to use it. Why should I dictate to them? And that's very unusual for a donor who gives such a significant sum of money to be able to say, like, I understand this is not about me, this is about what the organization needs. To me, that's amazing. That's really doing things in the right way. But the Ramah says most people are not like that. Most people want a dedication, and most people want to have their name all over something. And the Ramah says that's natural, that's human nature. And therefore, he says, this is why we learn that from this Mishnah over here, that the Mishnah tells us when a person is doing a difficult mitzvah, we as a community should try to encourage them to want to do more of the same. So this is reason number one that the Gemara gives as to why we stand up for the farmers when they come to offer the Bikurim in the Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim, because it's a difficult mitzvah. Number two, says the Gemara, the reason why we stand up for the farmer who brings Bikurim is because they are in the midst of they are about to perform a very important mitzvah. And we stand up out of respect to someone who's about to do a mitzvah. So let me give a few examples of that. You ever go to a Levaya? So they make an announcement at the beginning. All rise for the family. You ever heard that? No? All rise for the family. Why are we rising for the family? What? What mitzvah are they doing? Family? They're not really doing anything. They're showing up to the Levaya, right? So why do we rise for the family? So maybe you'll say, really, no, we're rising for the deceased. We're rising for the Aron. When they bring in the Aron into the room, we stand up. Yeah, but yesterday when this person was in shul and sat next to me before they passed away, I never stood up for them. So all of a sudden they die, now wow, now you have an elevated status, what's so special? So the Bartanura asked this question, not the Bartanura wine, the Bartanura asked this question on the side of the Mishnayos, where he wonders, why do we stand up by Levi? What's that all about? We never stood up for the person when they were alive. And why should we stand up for the family? And he says the answer is, we're not standing up for either. We're standing up for the Chevra Kadisha. The Chevra Kadisha are a group of people who are involved in a very difficult mitzvah. They're on call all the time. They get no credit for it. We stand up for people who are doing something special, who are engaged in a mitzvah. You go to a wedding, you ever think it's strange? Why do we stand up for a chasan and kala when they walk down the aisle? So most people think it's because chasan dom elamelech, you know, a chasan's like a king and a kala's like a queen. Which, first of all, I don't know if I shared this before, but if I didn't, I'm sharing it now. Keep it in mind. Did I? I did last semester. Okay, they deserve to hear it too. Right, okay. It's a recurring theme. So what did I say? You know, someone just told me this week. I think Rabbi Leibowitz told me this week, we were talking. So he told me that Rabbi Yonasan Sachs, he's a great Talmud Chacham in Passaic, and apparently every year on Sukkot, the first night of Sukkot, he gives the exact same shiur about Hilchos Sukkah every single year. And somebody in the shul once came over to him and said, you know, I'm just wondering, why do you give the exact same shiur? Like, we heard this last year and the year before and the 10 years before that. So Rabbi Sachs said, yeah, so tell it over to me.
Is there a palm
story? Yeah, there are palm story, yeah.
Okay.
I'm kidding, I'm not putting you on the spot.
No,
so there are palm story
I
was.
Because I retold
us. Yeah. Uh-huh, good. So, Amir Hashem, you should be able to implement it into the right person. So Rav Palm was once asked by a boy, you know, it says that Chasen Dom Elamelech, it says that when a chassan gets married, he's like a king. So how long does that status last? How long do I have the status of a king? Now, what does that mean? I don't even know. But that was his question. And Rav Palm answered him, so long as you treat your wife like a queen, you can continue to be a king. Take it home. Right? So long as you treat your wife like a queen, you can continue to be called a king. And you should strive to find someone who's going to treat you like a queen. Right? That's the person who deserves you. Somebody who treats you like a queen. That's what it is. So, why do we stand up for a chasan and kala when they walk down the aisle? So some people think it's because we have to have kavod, we have to have respect for the king and queen. It's not really true, because right now when they're walking down the aisle, they're not yet a king and queen. They didn't get married yet. There was no kiddushin, there was no nisu, and nothing happened. Right now, they're nothing. As far as the halacha is concerned, before they walk down the aisle, they're nothing. Until we actually do the ceremony, till we put the ring on the finger and say, Ariyam Mukudeshasli, nothing happens. So why do we stand up? The answer is we stand up because they're about to do a very important mitzvah. They're about to do the mitzvah of Kiddushin, Vinisuin, Apru Revu. They're about to do very important mitzvahs. And therefore, out of respect to the mitzvah that they're about to do, that is why we stand up. You ever go to a bris milah and everyone says, Kvater, stand up. Why are we standing up? What'd the kid ever do? The kid is 8 days old. And he hasn't learned the word of Torah. All he did is keep his parents up at night. So why are we standing up? The answer is we're standing up because the family, the parents, are about to do a very important mitzvah. So we stand up out of respect to those who are about to perform a mitzvah. And therefore, that is the reason why the Bartanura gives, that is the reason why we stand up for a person who is about to do a mitzvah, which is all learned from the mitzvah of Bikurim, that when we're about to do that mitzvah, we stand up in their honor. Now, what is the reason why we stand up for someone who's about to do a mitzvah? That's a good question. The Baal HaTanya writes very interestingly. He said the reason why is because Mipnei Hashem Hashochein Umislabesh Benafsho B'Shazu. When you're doing a mitzvah, you are the embodiment of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What a beautiful way to think about it. I'm doing HaKadosh Baruch Hu's mitzvah. You know, we say Shlucho Shaladim Kemoso. What does it mean? When I send a proxy to do something in my place, it's as if that person is actually me. So, technically, the halacha is, if I live in one city and I want to marry a woman who lives in another city, I'd be allowed to send a shaliach. It's a strange thing to do, to have somebody else marry the girl on my behalf. It's a strange thing to do. But the Gemara does say technically it would work. I'd be allowed to send a shaliach to go be mekadesh that woman on my behalf. Now, why would a person do such a thing? Why wouldn't you go marry her? The answer is because I'm concerned that somebody else is going to get her. And she's such a good catch. I have to be careful to make sure I get her as soon as possible. But right now I'm at the office, I'm at work, I can't do it. So I send a friend of mine to go, I mean, mekadesh the woman on my behalf. That works. Says the Balatanya, Shlucho Shalom Kemoso means, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu asked me to be his shaliach, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu asked me to do certain things on his behalf, he wants me to shake lulav, he wants me to sit in the sukkah, he wants me to observe Shabbos, it means when I'm doing all of those things, I am in the place of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I am in some way Kemoso, I am in some way an embodiment of the Ribono Shalom, of the Shekhinah. And that is why we stand up for a person who's about to observe a mitzvah, because we realize that upon doing so, they are the embodiment of HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. Okay, let me now move on to another important point from this Mishnah. The Mishnah says that the fikavod hanechnasim hayu yotzim, based on how important, how prominent the farmer may have been, that is the kind of reception they got when they came to Yerushalayim, when they came to the Beis HaMikdash. Now, the Yerushalmi asks a very, very powerful question. Ask the Yerushalmi, v'chiyesh katan v'gadol b'Yisrael? What does that mean? What does that mean? Based on how important you are, that's what kind of reception you got? Ask the Yerushalmi, do you believe that some people's mitzvah bikurim is better than others? We all have the same mitzvah. We all have the same mitzvah. We all have to observe the mitzvah of bringing bikurim. So what does it matter if I'm this or if I'm that? We don't care how prominent you are. Correct? Somebody just asked, I'm on a rabbi chat with Rabbi Yosef Tzvi Rimon. So somebody just asked a question today. He wanted to know, when you say Mishaberach for Cholim, and the person is a very prominent individual, let's say now Reb Shmuel Kamenetsky had a stroke last week, and people are davening for him. So how should we daven? What do we say? Shmuel, whatever his name is, Shmuel Yaakov, I think, Ben, whatever his mother's name is. We don't say Harav Shmuel Yaakov. When you're davening for someone, you're talking to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. As far as God is concerned, you're not a rabbi, you're not a Rebbetzin, you're not an anything. You're a simple nobody, you're a simple everybody, whatever you are, we're all the same. In the eyes of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, He values all of us. Either we're all worthless or we're all valuable. But we're all the same. We're all the same as far as HaKadosh Baruch Hu is concerned. So what does the Mishnah mean that based on how important you are, how prominent you are, that's the kind of reception we give you? What does that mean? Everyone is important in the eyes of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So that's why the Yerushalmi rejects this line of the Mishnah and reinterprets it. There's a Gemara Maseches Kiddushin where the Gemara says, Parnes, Kiven shenismana al hatzibur, aser sheyasa melacha b'fnei shlosha. What does that mean? If I'm elected to a public position, they make me the mayor of a town, they make me the governor of a state, whatever it may be, I have some kind of very prominent position. Once I take that position of leadership upon myself, I'm not allowed to do menial work, menial activities that are going to make people in town look down on me. So let's say my car breaks down, and I happen to be a mechanic, and I know how to fix things. So I just crawl onto the car, and I start fixing everything, and my hands are all dirty. You're not allowed to do that. Why are you not allowed to do that? Because you are now representative of something much larger than yourself. And you have to carry that representation seriously. You have to carry that responsibility. So the Gemara says that I have to be careful with what I do, what I do not do, because I don't want to demean the people that I represent by the position that I hold. Okay. Even though that's true, says the Gemara, Yachal hu livnos makeh, which means there's a mitzvah in the Torah that if I build a house and there's a roof on top of the house and I'm concerned that maybe someone could fall off, I have to build a fence around the roof to make sure that everyone's safe. Okay, how do you build a fence? Well, if you're like me and you don't know how to do anything, then you call somebody to build a fence. But what if you're very handy? What if you're very handy? You always need to have one person in the relationship who knows how to do things, right? Also a good tip for marriage. It's really a marriage class, I guess, right? So you have to, you know, when we got married, we lived in Washington Heights. You live in the Heights? You live in the Heights also? Yeah, you know, you'll see. There is such a concept as a mouse. They do exist in Washington Heights once in a while. Maybe not in your apartments. Mirzah Shem, you shouldn't have such things. There are cockroaches. There is such a reality in Washington Heights. It does exist. It's in New York City. So it's not for me. You know, Baruch Hashem, I married a woman who can handle such things. You know, she told me she went to Sternberg Pioneer. She knows how to be an outsider. She can do this. You know, I'm lucky. What would we do if we had a couple that couldn't figure out what to do when you have a mouse in the house? You know, it's a problem. So you got to make sure you have somebody who knows how to do things. Like, I don't know anything about finance. I don't know how to get into my bank account. My wife takes care of everything. She knows how to do this. So it's good. Works out. You know, everybody has a division of roles. Is that the way it works in your country? Same. All right. So here, let's say I have to build a roof on the fence. I have to build a fence on the roof. But I don't know how to do it. And my wife also doesn't know how to. So what do we do? hire someone. Now, what if I do know how to do it? I'm very handy, but I happen to be a communal leader. Says the Gemara. So just because you're a communal leader and you're not allowed to fix your car and get your hands all dirty doesn't mean you're not allowed to build a makkah. What's the difference? What's the difference? One is a mitzvah. When I'm fixing my car, I'm not allowed to put myself down and do some menial work that's beneath the dignity of someone who holds my position. But when I'm doing a mitzvah, I'm building a makkah, I'm building a fence on the roof because that's what God wants me to do. What do you feel ashamed about? What are you embarrassed about? You think it's beneath you to do such a thing? You know, there's someone in Eretz Yisrael that once ate by his house. He originally went to MTA. He was the captain of the basketball team. Then he went to the Mir Yeshiva when he was 18 years old and never came back. And now he's married with 10 children and they're all married, whatever it is. He's been long gone from MTA. It's been a long time. But he did show me a picture at his wedding. Reb Nosson Tzvi Finkel, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of the Mir Yeshiva, 5,000 Talmidim in the Yeshiva, came to the wedding, because this boy was in the Yeshiva for a long time, came to the wedding, and in the middle of the circle, there's a picture of him dribbling a basketball to be Misameach the Chassan. Reb Nosson Tzvi Finkel was also on the basketball team in Ida Crown in Chicago when he grew up. He knew that this boy, when he was younger, was also, and he knew it would give simcha to the chassan. So somebody gave him a basketball and said, go in the middle and dribble, and he did. Wouldn't you say it's like a little beneath one of the biggest Rosh Yeshiva in the world to do that? The answer is yes, it is beneath him, but it's for the mitzvah of Simchas Chassan Mekala. So the Chavos Yair, one of the great gedolim in the 17th century, Rabbi Yair Bachrach, so he writes about the following shayla. He says that there was a rabbi who was asked, a very prominent rabbi who was asked to come to a wedding and sing at the wedding. That's not the normal role that a rabbi plays at a wedding. Usually you're at a wedding and the rabbi does his thing and the singer does his thing. But yet at this wedding, the rabbi happened to have had a good voice. And the question was, should he participate in the band in order to be Misameach Nechassan Mekala? Or do you say, like, it's a little inappropriate? It's not exactly what they should be asking the rabbi to do. And the Chavos Yair responds, why wouldn't you do it? You have a mitzvah of Simchas Chassan Mekala. What do you think? It's beneath you to do the mitzvah? So when it comes to mitzvahs of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we never say that anyone is considered on a higher or lower level. Everybody shares the mitzvah opportunity together. There's an amazing story told in the Shari Tshuva. Shari Tshuva is on the page of Shulchan Aruch. It's in Hilchas Lulav, Simen Tuf Resh Nun Ches. So he writes an amusing story. He tells a story about a community in Europe where they couldn't get Lulav and Esrog one year before Sukkot. It's not like today where we have import-export. They couldn't find any Lulav and Esrog. Okay. There was one wealthy person in town who made an arrangement that he should have somebody travel from a very far distance and bring the Lulav and Esrog to the community for Yom Tif and to drop it off at his house. Comes the first morning of Sukkot, and everybody walks in and they're very sad that they don't have the mitzvah of Lulav and Esrog this year. What are they going to do? And this man walks in with his dalad minim, proudly showing everybody how lucky he is that he got this. And a big fight breaks out in Shul. People turn to him and they said, you know, it's admirable that you spent all this money and all this effort to try to get yourself a dalad minim. But now that the shul only has one set of dalad minim, it's not respectful for you to use it. We have a rabbi here. You should give it to the rabbi. He's the one who should use it. And the man turned back to them and he said, look, if the rabbi really wanted it, he should have made the efforts on his own to get one. But I'm the one who made the efforts. I'm the one who bought it. I have every right to use it. Why should I give it to the rabbi? So they put the rabbi in a very awkward position because they turned to the rabbi and said, "Nu, so what do you think? Kala, we were just talking about getting married. You just missed it. I said, we were just talking about getting married. Unfortunately, I responded to your invitation already. We're going to be in Camp Simcha, and because of germs, they don't let us leave. But you'll send me the Zoom. I'll be there. Should just have a mazel and bracha and simcha and nachas. Amazing. I'm not only missing the wedding, but the entire week of Sheva Brachas. We're going to be in Camp Simcha. But Mirtz Hashem, we should have many good milestones to share with you and your chassan and your family, Mirtz Hashem. We'll make up for it. How's that? Deal? Okay. So the Shari Tshuva writes that this fight breaks out in Shul. They don't know what to do about the Lulav. And the answer that the Shari Tshuva quotes from the rabbi is, this man is right. He has a right to keep it. Why is my mitzvah of Dalad Minim any more important than his mitzvah of Dalad Minim? We all share in the mitzvah of Dalad Minim equally. And the same way I have to shake the Dalad Minim, he also has to. So why should my mitzvah be more important than his, and why should I steal it from him? He has every right to do it, and he's the one who gets to keep it. The same idea, when it comes to a mitzvah, there's no hierarchy. there's all of us are the same. There's a story that's told. One of the Talmidim of the Brisker Rav told a story about on one occasion, the Brisker Rav made a bris for one of his grandchildren. And as you can imagine, all the Gedolim of Yerushalayim came to celebrate together with the Brisker Rav, and they all showed up. And the Brisker Rav turns to one of the great Talmidei Chachamim who was next to him, and he says, you know, maybe you could be mechabed everybody with some Divrei Torah, maybe you should say something. We're all here together for the celebration of the bris. Let's hear some Divrei Torah. So this rabbi gets up to speak, and he was a very prominent person, and he turns to everybody there, and he says, you know, it's so special to be here with such yichus in the room, with such holy people. A grandson of the Brisker Rav had a bris milah today. That was his introduction to his words, and the Brisker Rav turned to him and he said, okay, now you can sit down. He didn't understand what happened. And the Brisker Rav turned to him and he said, what does it matter whose grandchild it is that's having a bris milah? You think the bris milah is more important because it's my grandson instead of somebody else's? It's the same thing. You think HaKadosh Baruch Hu is more excited over my grandson's bris than over somebody else's? Doesn't make a difference. We're all the same. And don't get too excited about this over anything else. Just reminds me, when we went to the hospital when my wife was in labor with our first child. So it was on an Erev Shabbos. Ever told the story? Yeah. Last semester, a little bit. Okay, it was on an Erev Shabbos. And we came in right before Shabbos. Shabbos Chanukah. And all of a sudden, I started getting messages from people in YU, like, everything should go well, I heard, or whatever. Thinking like, who heard everything well, what? Turns out, there was a doctor who was an OBGYN, who was on rotation then, who had texted his brother in YU, Rav Schechter is having a grandchild. Which is like, if you're going to med school, you should be sued for that. That's HIPAA violation on steroids. But okay. So then I started getting all these messages like, oh, you know, Rav Schechter's having a grandson in New York. It must be you. And that was very uncomfortable. I'm just saying, don't try that at home. But it should be no more exciting that Rav Schechter's having a grandson than anybody else, right? We're all doing what we're supposed to be doing. We're all fulfilling the mitzvahs of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's what the Yerushalmi's question is all about. V'chiyesh katan v'gadol b'Yisrael. Is there such a concept that somebody is more or less important in the Jewish community? It doesn't work that way. In the eyes of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, all of us are considered to be valuable and everyone is considered to be important. One final point for discussion from this Mishnah is the following. Let's see, number Dalet. It says that, I'm sorry, we saw that already. We have a Mishnah Bikurim that says the following. When you come to the Beis HaMikdash to offer these first fruits of Bikurim, so there are certain psukim that you're supposed to mention when you're in the Beis HaMikdash. And the Torah discusses exactly how this should be done. Now, the Mishnah says, anybody who knows how to read the psukim would read the psukim. The Kohen would hold open the Chumash and you would read them. What if you have a farmer who was illiterate? What would that person do? So the Gemara says, if you have somebody who didn't know how to read, so the Kohen would say each word of the pasuk and the farmer would repeat after the Kohen, back and forth, back and forth. Then the Gemara says, the problem was, people would become so embarrassed to come to the Beis HaMikdash because I don't want to show off my ignorance. I'm in a long line of farmers. Everybody's coming to offer the Bikurim. Each one rattles off the psukim, could read it on their own, and all of a sudden I come, and I don't know how to read. So now I have to humiliate myself in front of everyone? Says the Gemara, because of that, people stop coming. I have to come to the Beis HaMikdash, spend all this time and money getting up to Yerushalayim, only to be humiliated when I get there? Not interested. People stop coming. Says the Gemara, as a result of that, they made a new takana. They made a new din derabanan that was, doesn't matter how smart you are, it doesn't matter how well-educated you are, everybody has the same standard. What is that standard? The Kohen says word for word to the individual so that we don't embarrass the person that doesn't know. Even if you're the most learned person in the world, the Kohen is going to tell you the words and then you repeat after him. Where is an example of that? An example of that would be by a wedding. When a chassan and kala get married, the chassan has to say harei amukudeshesli, right? Or, not only that, he's supposed to make a birchas erusin. The chassan is supposed to make the birchas erusin on his own. Why does the Masada Kedushin do it? It's not the Masada Kedushin's wedding. So why is the Masada Kedushin the one who's making the birchas? So he's really doing it on behalf of the chassan and kala. But why? Why don't you have them do it on their own? It's the same reason. Because it used to be that the chassan and kala would make it on their own. Then every once in a while we came to a situation where the chassan and kala didn't know how to read Hebrew. So they couldn't say the words, and that's embarrassing. Here I am standing under the chuppah, and everyone who's assembled has to see that I don't know how to read. So they started one uniform standard as not to embarrass people. The Masada Kedushin is always going to be the one to make the bracha. And this way, no one's ever going to be ashamed. No one's ever going to be embarrassed. We make one uniform standard to make sure that no one's ever going to feel bad. This is a very common, well-known concept in halacha that we find in many different places. The Gemara tells us a very interesting tidbit where we're told that when somebody used to sit Shiva, so they used to bring over all kinds of wines to that individual as they were sitting Shiva. Now, why they bring wine? Says the Gemara, because lo ivri yayin ela lenachem avelim. The whole reason why wine was created in the world was to be able to alleviate the anxiety, the suffering of a person who's struggling. When I have wine, sometimes it takes off the edge. And therefore the Gemara says the practice always was that in a Shiva house, they would drink wine. Because the person who's sitting Shiva is so distressed, is so anxious, and in order to lower the anxiety, they used to give them wine. Now, says the Gemara, depending on how prominent you were, how wealthy you were, that is the kind of wines that we gave you and the kinds of cups that we brought it in. If you were a very prominent family, then we brought it in gold and silver cups and we used to have very fancy wines. And if you were a simpler family, then the Gemara says we would bring you in plastic cups some grape juice. That was it. That's what they would bring. Then the Gemara says, what happened? It became very embarrassing. Somebody who sits Shiva has to show off to the world how much money they have. Everybody has to know my financial statements before I sit Shiva. So we have to know, look, it's important that we know. We have to know what kind of wines to bring you, what kind of cups to bring them in. It's embarrassing. Says the Gemara, people stop sitting Shiva. I have to sit Shiva, and now I have to be embarrassed while I'm sitting Shiva? It doesn't make sense. So the Gemara says they stopped. And they said, everybody has to have one uniform standard. Everyone's going to get the plastic cups with the grape juice in it, and everyone's going to be the same. And the same goes with tachrichim. Tachrichim is the clothing that we bury a person in as they're being lowered into the ground. It used to be, some people got the deluxe edition fancy tachrichim. Sounds a little strange, right? What do you care what you're buried in? And by Tchiyas HaMesim, I assume you're going to wear other clothing, not tachrichim, probably, right? You're not going to walk around in those. So who really cares? But the Gemara says there were people who wanted to have the deluxe edition tachrichim. And they used to buy the designer brands of tachrichim. And there were other people who bought the simple ones. And then the Gemara said it became very embarrassing that some people used to have a levaya with very fancy tachrichim that the mace was wearing. And other people had a very simple levaya, and that was very humiliating. So the Gemara says we made one uniform standard. Everybody has the same tachrichim. Everyone is buried in the simple shrouds. Nobody has any different. Nobody has more. Nobody has less. This way, it's one uniform standard because we are sensitive to the differences of different people. Now, here's the problem. Why is it that suddenly when it comes to Bikurim, we seem not to be concerned about it? The Mishnah says in Maseches Bikurim, you had all different kinds of families who were coming to offer Bikurim. Some of them were Ashirim. Some of these were farmers that were very successful farmers, had a lot of money. Others were very simple farmers. So says the Gemara as follows. The Mishnah tells us, what did they do? What happened when they used to show up for the Bikurim? Says the Mishnah, a very wealthy farmer, what do you think he brought his Bikurim in? Kalso shel kesev shel zav. They had gold and silver baskets, and they would walk into the Beis HaMikdash with all their fruits piled on into it, and they would do it as a respect to the mitzvah Bikurim. Right? The same way we use a silver Kiddush cup, and we use things that are nice when we're doing a mitzvah. So that's the way they would present their Bikurim. Right behind them in the line, there was a farmer who's just trying to eke out a living, who really doesn't have a lot. And what would he show up with? He would show up with a wicker basket. And inside the basket, he would have his fruits. Now, says the Mishnah, this is the way it worked. The wealthier farmers came with the gold and silver. The simpler farmers came with the wicker. And then the Mishnah says that the Kohen would empty out the gold and silver basket from its fruits, from its content. And then they would return the gold and silver basket back to the farmer. You know, you can take it home with you. But the wicker basket that was brought by the poor farmer, the Kohen took not only his fruits, but also his basket. So two questions. Number one, we seem to be so sensitive in different areas of halacha to people not feeling uncomfortable looking over their shoulder. What are other people doing? Am I the same status as them? And suddenly, when it comes to Bikurim, we're not worried. Why aren't we concerned that the farmer in front of me is going to walk in with a gold and silver basket, and I'm walking with my simple thing? I'm going to feel so uncomfortable. Why is that not of concern to us? It's question number one. Question number two is, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. Why is the rich farmer given back his gold and silver basket? And the poor farmer is sitting here, and not only does he have to give his fruits, but he also gives him the basket. Why? Why does the Kohen keep his basket? Those are the two questions that are asked by the commentaries on the Mishnayos. Let's learn together. The Malbim, in his Sefer on Chumash, gives such a fantastic explanation. It's so moving. Says the Malbim as follows. Derech ha'ani sha'osa ba'atzmo hatena. The reason why we say this here is because the poor farmer doesn't have money to go to the Judaica store, to go to the silver store and buy a basket. He can't afford that. All of his friends can, but he can't. So what does he do? He looks ahead 3 months ahead of time, and he says, I'm going to have to go to the Beis HaMikdash and bring my first fruits, bring my Bikur. But I have nothing to bring them in. So what does he do? Derech ha'ani sha'ose ba'atzmo hatene. The ani, the poor farmer, makes the basket himself. And he's making it specifically for this purpose, because he knows he has to bring Bikurim to the Beis HaMikdash, and he has nothing to bring them in. So what does he do every night when he comes home from a hard day at work? He sits down by the candlelight and he starts weaving his wicker basket, falls asleep as he's doing it, wakes up the next morning, does a little bit more. Over a few weeks' time, he finally has a basket that he worked really hard to create. Says the Malbim, Ba'avur shatarachba, because he exerted so much effort, because he invested of himself, Zacha sheye tafel bikurim, he is lucky that that now becomes a gift to the Kohen. Basically, says the Malbim, the Ashir, the wealthy man who shows up with his gold and silver basket, the Kohen says to him, you know, this is worth nothing to me. I don't care how much money you have. You worked nothing to have this. Take your basket and bring it home. We don't need that in the Beis HaMikdash. You know what we want to hold on to? Somebody who works hard. Somebody who invests in themselves. Somebody who exerts effort and energy and shows this is important to me and I was willing to work hard to get to this goal. The Kohen says, I value that so much. Not only do I keep your fruits, but I want to keep your basket also. I remember a number of years ago, I was in someone's house in our neighborhood. A very beautiful, beautiful house. A huge house. And I was talking to them in their living room, and I just couldn't hold back from noticing that there was, you know, you ever seen fake flowers? Sometimes fake flowers look, you know, pretty real, and sometimes they look really fake. Right? You've seen fake flowers, really bad? So they had the fakest fake flowers that I've ever seen were on their living room. And I thought it was so strange. They have, like, all this art all over the house, and it looks like you're in a museum. And all of a sudden, you come into the living room where people sit, and on the table, in the middle of the whole sitting area, is this fake bouquet of flowers. I thought it was so strange. And they explained to me. They told me. Maybe I was wrong for asking. I just said, what are these? It was so out of place. There must have been a story. And they explained to me what happened. They said they had a babysitter, a nanny, who worked in their house for years, raised all of their children. After the children were old enough to go to school, this woman stayed and cleaned the house and everything. She was always there. Literally a part of their family. Showed up to the kids' weddings. Everything was really a part of the family. At some point, this couple moved to Florida, you know, part-time. They were traveling to Eretz Yisrael here and there. They were hardly ever home. So what are they going to do with this woman? Not going to keep her on staff. Not going to keep her on salary. What are you going to do with her? They felt really bad, but they had to tell her, you know, you've been with us for 25 years, but, you know, we're going to have to find you a different place to work. The last day that she showed up to work, she came into the house with this fake bouquet of flowers. And she told them, you know, I've been saving up money. I really wanted to find something that was going to be meaningful to you. And I just want you to remember me. So I bought flowers that are never going to wither. And she gave it to them. And they said it was the most sincere gift they had ever been given by anyone. He said, we have a lot of wealthy friends, and we're all giving this and doing that and giving each other's children's gifts and everything. This woman saved up money to buy these fake flowers. But it was so heartfelt. It was so sincere. They said to us, this belongs in the center of our whole house. That's what real friendships are. A person who's willing to invest, a person who's willing to exert effort and energy, can there be anything more meaningful than that? Says the Malbim. You know, I think about it, for those who are from the five towns, you'll appreciate it even more. You go to Gourmet Glot before Yom Tov, and they sell everything pre-made. Everything. It's like, you know, they make pre-packaged 10 pieces of bread before Pesach.
Salt water.
They make salt water. You know that? Like, who can't figure out how to fill up a bowl of water and put some salt in it? I mean, it's really. Who remembers? Maybe you don't remember. Do any of you really have a memory of Hanukkah? I hate to get my hands dirty, trust me. I hate it. But do any of you remember when Hanukkah used to have to put the wick inside the silver thing? And like, it was really a mess. It wasn't just the pop-off tops that we have today. So I agree, it's much more convenient the way we have it. And I love it. I didn't like the old way. Like, there's something missing. There's something missing. That we don't have that feeling of ever exerting effort or energy into anything anymore. We don't have to. Everything's done. I think I told the story, but I have to repeat it because if any of you will ever make a mistake, it shouldn't be on my watch. There was a woman in our shul. I was once talking about this 10 pieces of bread. So anyway, this woman in shul came over to me. She told me they're staying home for the first days of Pesach, and then the first day of Chol HaMoed Pesach, they're going away to a hotel for the duration of Yom Tov. So they asked me, what do we do about Bedikas Chametz? I said, well, you're going to be home the night of Bedikas Chametz, so you have to do Bedikas Chametz there. But then you're going to a hotel on the first day of Chol HaMoed Pesach. It wasn't a Pesach hotel. They were going on their own. And I said, you have to do a Bedikas Chametz when you get to the hotel, because maybe the person who was there before you had cookies under the desk or under whatever, wherever it may be. You have to just do a quick Bedika around the room. Fine. So that's what I told him to do. Now, you'll say, there are people who come and clean the rooms. Yeah, but every so often you find things in the room that weren't cleaned up, right? Sometimes you come in and you find an article of clothing from someone who was there before you. No, never happened? So it happens. So maybe there's going to be chametz in the room as well. Nobody was specifically looking for it. So therefore you have to do a bedika before you go on Pesach. Okay. So the woman calls me and says, well, I'm in Gourmet Glot now. I'm buying the 10 pieces of bread so that I can put them out on Chol HaMoed to do the bedika. So I just want to know, do I make a bracha on Chol HaMoed when I'm doing the bedika with the 10 pieces? And I'm like, shomu shamayim, I can't believe this. I didn't think I had to say that. No, you're not allowed to buy chametz on Pesach and go put it out in the room. That would be like, bayiro, bayimatzeh, midaraisa. Like, really? Did I have to say that? So anyway, just make it clear to all of you, don't make that mistake. You have to do a bedika, but obviously you don't put chametz out on Pesach. That would not be the appropriate way to deal with it. Anyway, says the Malbim. With this understanding, the Malbim explains, now we can know why. Says the Malbim, why is it that we don't have a uniform standard when it comes to this mitzvah bikurim? How come when it comes to a chuppah and we're afraid someone's not going to know how to read, we have one uniform standard? Why is it when we have all these different examples, we make sure to do it in a way where no one's going to be ashamed, no one's going to be embarrassed? And all of a sudden it comes to Bikurim and no one's concerned about it. Answers the Malbim, you know why? What do you have to be embarrassed about? You should be so proud. Look at the Kohen celebrating what you've done. You're embarrassed of the person behind you who went to the Judaica store and bought for $150 a basket, $500, $1,000. Who cares? What value is that in the Jewish community? Do I care that his basket costs $1,000? It's worth nothing to me, says the Kohen. You know what? Take your basket and bring it home. It's worth nothing. You know what's worth something to me? The Ani, who spent his time making his own basket, bringing it to the Beis Hamikdash, traveling here at his own expense, understanding what a commitment it is to be a part of the mitzvah and connecting with HaKadosh Baruch Hu while doing so, that's a basket I want to keep. You have nothing to be ashamed of, nothing to be embarrassed of. You have everything to be proud of. And that is why, by Bikurim in particular, we don't find this discrepancy. We don't find that we do something to make a uniform standard. Every Shabbos, at the end of Shabbos, we know that we smell the besamim when we make Havdalah. Why do we smell the besamim? So the Gemara says the reason why is because there's an assumption that on Shabbos we have a neshama yisera. On Shabbos we're given some kind of extra neshama. And when Shabbos is over, that neshama leaves. So we feel very upset about the fact, very distressed about the fact that our special neshama left. And therefore we have to smell the besamim to appease ourselves, to make ourselves feel better about the fact that we no longer have that special neshama. So we smell the besamim. Okay, what about after Yom Tov? So after Yom Tov, we don't smell the besamim. Why do we not smell the besamim after Yom Tov? What? You don't have a neshama yisera on Yom Tov? Really? So the Bali Atosas say, what you said. Obviously, there's no neshama yisera on Yom Tov, because if there was, we would smell the besamim at the end. And the other Rishonim say, what do you mean there's no neshama yisera on Yom Tov? Don't we know that on Yom Tov we say nishmas, nishmas kol chai, we say on Shabbos morning. Why do we say it? It's a celebration of the neshama yisera. We thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for giving us the neshama yisera, and we say that on Shabbos and on Yom Tov. So we assume that we do have a neshama yisera on Shabbos and Yom Tov. Well, if that's the case, why do we not smell the besamim? What? So the Ramban answers. The Ramban is a little cryptic. It doesn't explain it. The Shemi Shmuel explains what the Ramban means. The Shemi Shmuel writes as follows. Of course, on Yom Tov, there is also a neshama yisera. However, explains the Shemi Shmuel, on Yom Tov, after Yom Tov is over, the neshama yisera doesn't leave us. The neshama yisera stays with us, even after Yom Tov is over. Why is that? How come on Shabbos, the moment Shabbos is over, the neshama yisera is gone? And on Yom Tov, after the Neshama Yisera has spent Yom Tov with us, it stays. What's the difference? Explains the Shem Yishmuel as follows. Shabbos, right? You ever daven on Shabbos? We say, Mikadesh HaShabbos. That's the end of the Kiddush. It's the end of the davening. Mikadesh HaShabbos. What do we say on Yom Tov? Mikadesh? Yisrael Vahazmanim. Hey, why did Jewish people come into this? Mikadesh Yisrael Vahazmanim. It should be Mikadesh Yisrael VaHashabbos. What's the difference? So it's the Gemara's question. Why is it that on Shabbos we end off by saying Mikadosh HaShabbos, and on Yom Tov we end off by saying Mikadosh Yisrael VaHazmanim? Why did Jewish people get involved in the bracha? What happened? We should thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for giving sanctity to the Zmanim, which means to the Yamim Tovim. Why do we have this discrepancy in the bracha? The answer is, says the Gemara, because Shabbos is Kaviya V'Kaima. Shabbos comes every seventh day, whether we like it or not, it's going to be here anyway. Whether we prepare for Shabbos or not, it's always going to be here. And Yom Tov, on the other hand, is not that way. Yom Tov requires our participation. We need to be Koveya Yom Tov. We need to say today is Rosh Chodesh, and the implication of today being Rosh Chodesh is that in 2 weeks from now it's going to be Pesach. Without us declaring Rosh Chodesh, without us having an involvement, the holiday, the Yom Tov, would never happen. And that is why on Yom Tov we say Mikadesh Yisrael VaHazmanim, which means the only way that this Yom Tov came to be is because God sanctified all of us. And as a result of the sanctity that he gave us, we then in turn sanctify a day with the Kedusha that we have. We infuse a day with Kedusha as well. Says the Shemi Shmuel, Shabbos, which comes every week, whether we like it or not, whether we invest in it or not, Shabbos is going to be here regardless. So, we get a Neshama Yisera. The moment Shabbos is over, we worked hard to bring that Neshama Yisera in. No, the Neshama Yisera came regardless of our efforts. And therefore, the moment Shabbos is over, easy come, easy go. Yom Tov, which required our participation, it required us to exert effort and energy to bring that reality into the world, that Neshama Yisera, something that you worked hard to bring into the world, is not lost. It's there for eternity. It's there even way after the Yom Tov is over. And this really is what Rav Soloveitchik writes when he talks about the contrast between Har Sinai and Har Moriah, a very famous piece that he has on Chumash, beautiful piece. You ever think about it? The two most important mountains that we have in Judaism are Har Sinai and Har Moriah, but there's one major difference. Har Moriah, we paskin kitshali asadava. We assume even after the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, it still retains its status of Kedusha. Har Sinai, which is probably a much more important mountain, that's where it all started, that's where everything happened. Har Sinai, we assume, if you were to find and locate Har Sinai today, there would be no restriction. Torah says, Bimshol Chayovel, Hey Mayala Bahar, which means once they blew the shofar at Har Sinai and the experience was over, everyone had a right to go up on the mountain and there were no restrictions or limitations at all. What's the difference? Says Rav Soloveitchik, what happened by Maamon Har Sinai? HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God came, rested his Shekhinah on the mountain. We did nothing. We weren't deserving. We didn't invest in this. So the Ribbono Shel Olam came, the Ribbono Shel Olam left. Once he's gone, the Kedusha is gone. How did Har Sinai, how did Har Moriah, how did the Har Abayis get its Kedusha? That didn't happen by itself. That started when Avraham Avinu decided to sacrifice Yitzchak, when he was willing to be Moser Nefesh, and from that day and on, Jews have been willing to sacrifice themselves in so many different ways in the service of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. When something is created because people are willing to exert effort and energy to bring that into the world, that is something that is for eternity. And even after there's no Beis HaMikdash, it doesn't make a difference. That mountain retains its Kedusha because we're talking about something that was created by the efforts of human beings because of our investment. Now we daven every day. Oh wow, I'm over time. We daven every day. Tika b'shofar gadol l'cheruseinu. Right? What does it mean? That Hashem should bring us to our redemption. You ever wonder if we describe shofar gadol, what's the shofar katam? Never thought about the question, right? It's a pasuk in the Navi Yeshaya. V'haya b'yom ahu yitaka b'shofar gadol. Talking about a day when HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to blow a big shofar. Why a big shofar? What's the little one? So the Medrash asks the question, what's the shofar katan and what's the shofar gadol? So the Medrash says, shofar katan is the shofar that Hashem blew at Har Sinai. Shofar gadol, you know what the shofar gadol is that's going to bring Mashiach? That's the shofar of Avraham Avinu's little animal that he found by the Akedah, by Har Sinai, by Har Moriah, when he was about to sacrifice his son. There was a little horn on that ram. And that's the shofar gadol that's going to bring the redemption. Sounds backwards, no? I would have said, if we're describing a shofar gadol, I would have said, the shofar that God himself blew on Maamon Har Sinai should be the greatest shofar that we're ever going to hear about. But the answer is no. The greatest shofar that you'll ever hear, the one that's going to bring Mashiach, is the one that came from the investment of Avraham Avinu and all those who have come subsequently to do the same work that Avraham Avinu has done. And that is to invest of themselves. The most valuable thing we can do as people, not only in religion, but in everything we do, in every relationship, is to show others that we are sincere and genuine in our investment in what the relationship means. This goes not only for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but it goes for everything that we have in any relationship. The more we show people that we are willing to have a genuineness, that we're willing to exert ourselves, that we're willing to invest in what the relationship means to us and show them not just the token, I'm not just going to drop off a check, but I'm going to be thoughtful, I'm going to be mindful, I'm going to exert myself to try to do something to show you that I really appreciate who you are. And especially in the service of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that's what lasts for eternity. Those are relationships that are most meaningful to all of us in our lives and will be meaningful to other people who you interact with as well. And Emir Tzashem, we should have the opportunity to live lives of giving Nachas Ruach to HaKadosh Baruch Hu by showing him our investment. Not only to give Nachas Ruach to him, but to give Nachas Ruach to our spouses, to our children, to allow them to see and to be able to receive from them as well a genuine sense of care, a genuine sense of investment, being able to see that they're really interested in our future and our successes and everything that we plan to do and all that we want to accomplish. Those are the most meaningful aspects of the lives that we are going to be so blessed to live.